Did you know Nerd and Tie is a whole network of shows? Not just this one, but other shows like BS Free Witchcraft, a monthly witchcraft podcast, or Stormwood and Associates, our latest actual play podcast. You can find all of our shows and all bunch of other neat stuff, including the latest in convention coverage, at our website, nerdandtie.com. If you forgot where you were, it's nerdandtie.com. That's right. The place that exists on the internet, nerdandtie.com. We're technically a network.
And on this episode of Nerd and Tie, KamehameHaCon UK has been canceled. We guess Game of Thrones ended? And our big topic tonight, does adherence to the source material make something good? I'm one of your hosts, Gen Proc, joined as usual by the wonderful Trey Dorn.
Wow, okay. I'll fade out the theme song now, I guess.
And the fantastic Nikizumi.
Destroy the launch pad! Let none escape!
Especially not Launchpad McQuack, apparently. I don't know what you got against him. Just because he can't land a plane safely.
Shockwave does not value that lack of skill.
Who would win in a fight, Launchpad McQuack or Shockwave?
Which version of Shockwave?
Which version of Launchpad McQuack?
Well, I'm just saying, like, any version of Launchpad McQuack, I'm going to give the leg up on G1 cartoon Shockwave, because he's an idiot who turned into a gun but still couldn't hit anything. Well, with his gun hand,
but I'm...
as opposed to comic book Shockwave, who was a ridiculous bamf and frightens me.
Right, okay, but Launchpad McQuack in DuckTales was really competent and knew what he was doing. He just also always crashed the plane, right? While, on the other hand, Darkwing Duck Launchpad McQuack was really stupid, even though he was the same character.
But this is assuming we still give Launchpad his plane, correct?
What if the plane we give him is Starscream?
Yes.
Then I feel like Launchpad, this is going to end with Launchpad McQuack getting like whatever the Autobot equivalent of the Medal of Honor is for taking out not one, but two major members of Decepticon leadership.
But Starscream has an immortal spark, remember? So he could keep crashing Starscream as many times as he needed to without having to go get a new plane.
Mm-hmm. Well, even better. Like I said, if we're in the specific case of animated Shockwave, Launchpad McQuack has it in the bag. If it's literally any other version of Shockwave, I don't think he's going to be so lucky.
I haven't watched enough of the reboot of DuckTales to know whether or not, like, the capability level of reboot Launchpad McQuack.
He's still pretty not great at, like, landing things.
Well, I assumed that part. But whether or not his characterization is the competent versus the incompetent, these are questions, man. These are important fan questions.
Important questions.
If you have an opinion on how Launchpad McQuack would go up against Shockwave, feel free to tell us by going to nerdandtie.com/contact and filling in the form. We'd love to hear your opinion.
I was just thinking about, like, you know, what if we just, like, gave him a mech? What if, like, DuckTales in mech?
You mean Gizmo Duck?
Yeah, but for everyone.
Blatherskite.
For all of them.
I could see it.
And the triplets would just be like three smaller mechs that would combine into one big one.
I was going to say, they'd absolutely have a combiner.
Huey, Dewey, and Louie be with piloting a gestalt, like, what is just a Megazord?
Maybe something like Getter Robo, where depending on who forms the head, it forms a drastically different robot.
Yeah.
I'm liking this.
All I know is that Dewey definitely forms the leg.
Go to Guy's DuckTales. Please make this happen.
Yes!
Oh,
DuckTales
dear.
Robo versus Devil Man.
Yes.
No. Y'all are canceled.
Okay, episode over.
First time.
Good night, everyone.
All right.
Speaking of things that are canceled.
Oh.
Oh boy.
KamehameHaCon in the UK has been canceled.
Oh really?
Yeah. Yep.
That's
something bad happened to KamehameHaCon. No.
So okay. KamehameHaCon, we all remember the Texas incarnation of KamehameHaCon. Was the subject of one of our top stories a couple episodes ago, because they just because, you know, we can't get through another episode at least mentioning Vic Mignogna.
Nope.
Apparently. So KamehameHaCon US, the Texas one, they originally had announced that they were canceling Vic Mignogna's appearance and that whole kerfuffle. And then after the refund point issued, they re-announced that he was coming back and that he was going to be there, which made a lot of people mad and made Vic stans very happy, even though they can't really see the writing on the wall of whatever. They're bad and they are on the wrong side of history. Anyways, KamehameHaCon UK, the group was going to start a UK-based convention. KamehameHaCon UK only ever really had two announced guests, as far as I can tell, and they were originally Vic and then Sonny Strait, and they canceled Vic's appearance. Now, here's where I speculate. This is wild speculation. So, one of the prevailing theories about why Vic Mignogna was re-invited to KamehameHaCon UK, to KamehameHaCon US, to the Texas KamehameHaCon, was because KamehameHaCon's guest contracts actually don't let the con cancel for anything except for a very narrow specific set of reasons. And because Vic's cancellation didn't fall into those reasons, people have theorized, and we have no evidence of this beyond just knowing what the contract looked like and the fact that Vic has been in a litigious mood, that people theorized that he threatened the convention with a lawsuit because they would have been in breach of contract. Like, his cancellation would have been in breach of contract. Now, the UK con was canceled indefinitely, according to the official KamehameHaCon UK Facebook page, and they set about doing refunds, but it was pretty much like it was done to, quote unquote, through our decision comes on the back of recent events within the fandom. This is not due to fans directly, our community, but yeah, it's recent events within the fandom, which really means that, and this is the theory, that they've been having a hard time scheduling guests because, like, it's the only two guests booked, and it's one of the reasons why people think they're having a hard time getting guests, because they're in the UK, and unlike American anime cons where you can get the English voice actors on a domestic flight, everyone's got to fly internationally.
Uh-huh.
Right? Whether you get a UK or Japanese voice actor, you've got to bring him in from, not a UK, a US or Japanese voice actor, you got to bring him from out of the country to bring him to the UK. And it's also theorized that, you know what the easiest way to get out of contract with Vic Mignogna would be? To cancel the whole convention.
Jeez.
Again, that is speculation. That is a theory. That is, it's the prevailing rumor, but we don't have any evidence straight from the con that that's the case. Either way, like, it's, I think it's a combination of factors of just how expensive it would be to get other guests and the fact that they might not have been able to get out of bringing Vic, which would, of course, make it harder to get other affordable guests who might not want to be at the same con as Mr. Mignogna. So,
seems legit.
So while I think KamehameHaCon in Texas, their U.S. branch, is going to continue and be fine. I think the writing was really on the wall for their U.K. expansion.
Yeah, I makes sense to me. I mean, it's... I cannot imagine trying to run a con in... at least an anime con in the U.K. That feels...
Well, the U.K. convention scene is just so much more, like, I don't know. It's I've been looking at it because, you know, I looked a lot into the Walker Stalker Fan Fest event stuff.
Right.
And it is not a cheap proposition, and there's a lot of autograph fests, and it's, I don't know. I don't know if it's necessarily the... It's. I don't think it's worth it for an American company to run a convention in the U.K. I think that... it's the costs, the running costs, all of the stuff. Like, I'm not saying a convention can't be run successfully in the United Kingdom. I think one can. I think it can be run successfully if it's run by people there.
Yeah.
I was about to say,
the whole idea about running a convention in a whole nother country, like, I it just doesn't make sense to me. Like, it's hard enough to keep track of expenses in the same country.
Well, and, you know, you can get, like, there are enough things that film in the UK that even involve American actors that you can bring in larger names. I think you can bring in some cases, larger names to a UK convention than you can bring some of the smaller names from US cons.
Like, I was about to say, one of my friends who grew up in the UK said, like, UK Comic Cons especially, it was really easy for them to get, like, Grant Morrison or James Roberts because they just live a few miles away.
Right,
you
but,
know?
But with Pinewood Studios in the country, like, it's, you can, like, even, I don't know. And so also, though, if you're going to pay a lot of money to bring out an American actor from the U.S., you know, if you're going to pay that much money, it's, like, the cost versus the amount of monetary return. Like, I don't think you can run a U.S. style anime convention in the U.K., especially since like anime conventions, the assumption usually is that autographs are free. Like, it's, there's like, you'll see anime cons that charge for autographs, but they're very rare, and they're only for like specific people. Like, the level of access to the guests at an anime cons are all driven by the appearance fee model and not the guarantee model.
Right.
And the guarantee model is what, like, so if you spend a ton of money to bring out, you know, an actor, you can charge for those autographs. You can't, the anime con world doesn't function like that. And so I don't think it's, and the only reason why it does function is, well, in Texas especially, I mean, like, Kamehacon, Their U.S. con was in Texas. Like, their margins on bringing in half the cast of any show are minuscule because while they have to, you know, still pay appearance fees, like, transportation costs are, like, significantly less, like, versus cons in other parts of the country.
Plus, with the title Kamehacon, with the kind of implied Dragon Ball focus.
Yeah, it is a Dragon Ball con.
Yeah, it's literally where Dragon Ball is recorded, is,
well,
yeah, in Texas. So
there is, God, I forget what it's called. There is, ironically, also a Dragon Ball Z con launching in the UK this year that's run by people from the UK.
Huh. That seems like a better decision.
Right.
Yeah, it's...
It's like...
Sayacon.
The people who like the dub will not like your pronunciation, but I love your pronunciation.
How's it supposed to be pronounced?
In the Japanese, the term is Saiyajin. So I think Saiyan is the correct pronunciation, but every dub has gone with Saiyan.
Okay, good. Because I was just pronouncing, because I'm not a Dragon Ball. Like, I watched the original Dragon Ball, but not Dragon Ball Z.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, and it was probably decades ago. It was the 90s. So, like, I just pronounced it the way that I would pronounce a Japanese word that was romanized like that. And they've got, like, they've got, so Sayakon is still happening, and so they get to be the first, they get to be the, Stay being the first, Dragon Ball Z Con in the UK. And they've got, let's see here, they've got, Peter Kalamas, Josh Martin, Chuck Huber, Ian Sinclair, and Chris Rager.
Okay.
Who, see, the thing that... No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, they've got five voice actors from the series, and none of them are Vic. And they'll actually happen.
I just think... like, each country has its own, like, culture, and that pertains to their, like, anime conventions as well. Like, each convention that's run in a different country is going to be slightly different just based on, you know, the people there and the culture there. Like, anime conventions are a certain way because they're American. Or, like, American anime conventions are a certain way because they're American. And so I don't know if taking the like Americanized anime convention and plopping it in another country is going to work that well.
Well, I mean, the American comic convention's already been kind of imported that way. Comic-Cons have already shown up over there for a while. So, and it's still, and it's very much the autograph fest that in comic conventions are. It's, I don't know. It's, we're talking about a much smaller country. So,
true.
Yeah.
I know that anime cons in the Czech Republic run pretty much the way they run here, thanks to my communications with people who run one of the two anime conventions in the Czech Republic.
Wait.
Yeah, they read unconventional.
Huh.
I don't know. It's mostly, I think it's interesting that we probably shouldn't spend that much more time on Kamehacon UK. But it looks like, it really looks like this is fallout with the Vic situation.
Right.
Only because they directly said, do, you know, on the back of recent events within the fandom. Like, they literally said it. So, like,
I would say, like, the only other major thing that the Dragon Ball fandom has had was that their movie did really well.
Right. So, and you don't cancel your convention because it became less popular or more popular.
Uh-huh.
Oof, we should move on.
Okay. Yeah,
let's move on.
Let us go to a happier place.
Really? Premium cable?
Okay, I guess this really isn't a happier place. This is an objectively less happy place. Long ago, in days of yore,
we let Gen introduce the topic.
Yeah.
Go.
Last episode was your episode, Nick.
Fair.
For the past, was it like 10 years? It's been a long time.
Something like that.
Game of Thrones has been on, you know, HBO, and people have been going nuts about it for years and years and years. First episode was back in 2011.
Wow.
And it recently ended.
Yo.
The show finally ended.
As all things must.
Some people liked the ending. Some people didn't. Sounds pretty normal.
Yeah. It's
everybody gets their hopes like super, super high. And then gets really upset when it's not exactly what they want.
We are So we're a geek podcast and a nerd podcast where literally none of us watched Game of Thrones. Nick watched it a little bit at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never watched it. And again, I don't think you've ever watched it.
Nope.
And like, okay, so I'm sure that there's someone be lining up saying, oh, you think you're so cool, you never watched Game of Thrones. No, I just...
No.
No.
I don't steal things anymore. And I don't feel like paying for HBO.
And I don't place any value on whether or not I watch a popular TV show.
Right. And it's
like,
okay if
none
you,
of my
yeah.
personal value in myself is based on that.
But we also want to make it clear, it's okay if you watched it and enjoyed it. We're not like, we're not being critical of people who like things. For the, I mean,
we're not here to yuck your yums.
We're not. But unless you really like Vic Mignogna, then we definitely are. But like, it's so weird being a nerd who never watches the show because like the feed just gets dominated by it, and then you get people defensively like making posts about making like saying how rude people who don't watch the show are. But I'm like, I never said anything. But okay, I don't know. We used to.
I know so much about the show solely through osmosis.
Yeah,
same.
like I can name a few of the characters. I don't know much about them, but I know who they are.
You know, my favorite Game of Thrones quote, you know, Jon Snow winter is around the corner.
Yep.
It was an interesting. Like, yeah, it was one of those things. That was my biggest issue with the ending of this show, was just being exposed ad nauseum to people who were very indignant about the idea that some people weren't watching the show, or that they expressed, you know, or expressed, oh, I don't watch this show. I guarantee you, it's not that I think I'm better than you. I just didn't watch it.
Yeah.
Yep. So, wasn't that ending wonderful and or the worst thing ever? Those are the two. Those are the two things in my Facebook feed.
Yeah.
There are people who thought it was amazing, and then people who thought it was awful. And to the people who thought it was awful, all I have to say is one of those guys wrote X-Men Origins Wolverine. I don't know what you were expecting, but one of the two showrunners wrote X-Men Origins Wolverine.
So my wife, briefly read, she started reading the books and got frustrated with the way that they jump around in time and couldn't get through them. But I was amused because, like, when she was halfway through the first book, she gave a guess as to who was going to be sitting on the throne at the end of the story, and apparently she was right. And I think that's hilarious.
Well, and I can understand that it was very hard for the writers, you know, because the book series isn't finished.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, we, if you want to get deep in the lore, we technically don't know how the story ends yet.
Right.
We really don't. So.
Yeah.
But that brings us to our big topic.
A big topic, you say?
Our big topic.
A bag to pack.
Which is, does adherence to the source material make something good? Does adhering to the books make, like, would adhering to the books make the show better? Would it make it worse?
That
I don't know, because I haven't seen or read anything about them. Like,
in the case of Game of Thrones, I can objectively tell you that if they adhered to the books, there would be a lot more sexual assault.
I would say if they adhered to the books, we'd still be waiting like another 10 years for season 6.
That too.
I mean, I think in most cases though, like, people prefer when movies or shows do adhere to the book, mm-hmm. especially if they've read that book. But I mean, it could be understand.
So but, I think but it's, there. I think it's. Sorry, Nick. You were gonna say something.
No, I was gonna say, but yeah, and it's really it's always like the easiest explanation of this adaptation didn't work because it didn't follow the book. If it just would have followed the book, that would have fixed it. And I think that sometimes that's too easy of an answer.
Especially because like it's like people don't understand how hard it is to adapt books into video media because there's so much content mm-hmm. in books that if you did like my best example of this is the Lord of the Rings films versus the Hobbit films.
Perfect example.
Yeah.
Right. And like I don't like the Hobbit films as much as the Lord of the Rings films because I feel like they but mainly because like there's just not enough content in the Hobbit to make 3 films.
They didn't need to make
3 films.
I completely, especially when you look at like the animated Hobbit movie, you can get through that whole movie like before Bilbo even leaves Bag End in the live action one.
Yeah.
I'm not even kidding.
Yeah, it's so slow paced and like I feel like they tried to emulate the Lord of the Rings films too much. Whereas the Lord of the Rings films really worked because it was one book per film. And yes, they had to cut things out, but like that's a normal thing that happens with movies.
And I think they cut the right things, frankly.
Yeah.
I find the Tom Bombadil chapters to be painfully boring to read.
Well, and like, plus him as a character is so like enigmatic that if you tried to like even in the books, a lot of us don't like even Tolkien himself. I think we don't understand exactly what Tom Bombadil is. And if you try to put that in a film for the general audience who knows nothing about these books and doesn't know the lore behind it all, they're going to get so confused by this like pretty much God just like playing
this
around
random
with the ring
star that they just hang out with. Yeah.
Right? And he takes away how dangerous the ring is.
Hmm.
You know, because he's just sitting there like, oh, it has no effect on me. Do, 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 do. Whoop de doo. This is fun. And so, like, I agree that I'm okay with Tom not being in the films. But I'm also really glad that the Lord of the Rings movies, like, did adhere pretty well to the books. You know,
that's fair.
They didn't have to add in extra stuff like in the Hobbit films.
Sorry. Did you want to get your point in, Trey? Because I have a counterexample after that.
I was just enjoying listening to Gen talk, so you go ahead.
Oh, okay. Because, like, on the other end of the spectrum, when it comes to like adherence to the book, I actually feel that the parts of the live action Watchmen movie. I feel that that movie is hurt when it adheres too much to the book, because some of the dialogue that Alan Moore wrote works really well in the comic, but hearing an actual flesh and blood human say it, it's stilted and weird, and it doesn't mesh with the parts of the script that aren't from the book. Like, it's really easy to tell what was written for the movie and what was just copy pasted from the original novel.
Yeah, that explains why I always felt like that movie was like chunks.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't flow very nicely.
And like a lot of people are really quick to complain, well, they changed the ending from the book. Well, yes, they did change the ending from the book, but the problem isn't that they changed what the ending is. I'm going to spoil a movie from 10 years ago, so I'm sorry if you haven't seen the Watchmen movie. But in the movie, they just Ozymandias creates a super bomb to make it look like Dr. Manhattan, this godlike superhero, blew up a bunch of major cities all over the Earth, and everyone's so upset by this that they band together to fight a future threat from Dr. Manhattan, thus ending the Cold War. Now, comparatively, in the book, Ozymandias gets a bunch of comic book creators and biologists together to create a fake alien who psychically explodes, killing just a ton of people in New York, and then the Cold War is ended when people get ready for an alien invasion and not a Dr. Manhattan invasion. I don't feel that the change in and of itself is a bad thing, but where it doesn't work was that they kept in tons of lines from the book, including the line, in reference to Dr. Manhattan, God exists and he is American. They spend the entire movie building up that Dr. Manhattan is America's first, last, and only line of defense in the Cold War. And then a bunch of Dr. Manhattan bombs go off, and everyone just kumbayas with the U.S. instead of blaming the United States at the end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't make any sense. That's bad adaptation.
What year did Watchmen come out again?
That was, I think 2009.
2009. Well, okay, so I've got a couple of points here. Okay. I think that to go back to your, like, I think it's because adherence to the source material is more than one thing. There's adherence to the spirit, and there's adherence to the text. So what you're talking about with Watchmen is when we talk about when it adheres to the text but not the spirit of it is when we're getting the lines straight out of the comic, when we're getting the exact same visuals as though the comic was just used as a storyboard. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. The best part of Watchmen is the opening montage.
I agree.
And it's all downhill from there. But, like, so first off, I do want to comment that the reason why I think that you had everyone banding together with the U.S., even though it was a thing, is because I think there's a lot of 9/11 in there.
That's entirely fair and very likely.
But like similarly, like take Dune, 1984's the adaptation, not to be confused with the forthcoming adaptation that isn't out yet, or the Sci-Fi Channel adaptation. Dune, like they do this goofy thing in Dune where like all the stuff that's like the internal monologue of a character, like that's their thoughts, they just have the characters whisper on screen. Like it's ridiculous in an attempt to like try to adapt that, but. So like what you get is like if you adapt the trappings and the setting but don't really get the spirit of the original, like that's where I think it fails. Like take the first Bryan Singer X-Men movie, right? Mm-hmm. That plays a lot with the text. It's Wolverine and Rogue don't have that relationship in the comics, but Wolverine does have that relationship with several young women characters who he acts like a father figure to, with Shadowcat and with Jubilee, right? And
correct.
So adapting that relationship was adapted to go alongside Rogue, and it fits true to those characters, where in the comics, Rogue at that point in her life would instead have been brought in by Mystique and became a villain and then became a hero later. Like, they intersected those characters at points that were very true to them from the source material and then brought them, but they used them differently than they were in the source material. That's not a straight adaptation of the text. It's very different. But it is an adherence to the text in spirit. Like,
right.
It is the spirit of those characters. Just likewise, just because no one could have gotten away with a superhero movie in the regular outfits they wore. Everybody wore black leather in that movie, and everyone was okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what it took to get the X-Men on screen back then. And I will always be annoyed that when they had Sabretooth in X-Men, just in X-Men Origins Wolverine, when Sabretooth, like, I'm not saying Lee Schreiber's a bad choice, because, again, the best part of X-Men Origins Wolverines is the opening sequence, and then it's all downhill from there. I was annoyed that they didn't bring back the Edge to play Sabretooth in in other stuff because The Edge is an amazing... That was The Edge, right? I'm not crazy.
I don't remember.
The Edge. I'm going to Google that. Maybe it wasn't him.
But no, I...
Sorry. But I just want to... Sorry to jump back in.
Oh, no, you're fine.
But, like, it's... There's so many... So I think that it... To get back to it, though, it's like... Watchmen... Like, Watchmen, like... So Watchmen is actually a really interesting example for a ton of different reasons. Because, okay, so the Dr. Manhattan thing works when it doesn't work. It's an iffy thing, but it's completely understandable why that change was made. Because in the Watchmen... So in the Watchmen graphic novel... The way that the squid is introduced is through newspaper clippings about missing artists. It's like there are clues here, clues there, and they're all done through
and
almost...
And it wouldn't have worked in a film. Yeah,
they're done
that.
Through metatext. And so...
I like the idea, just not the execution, I guess.
Right, it's... I'm not saying that how they executed it was good. You know what I mean? It's... Oh, it was Tyler Mane in the X-Men movie. Okay. Wow, wrong wrestler.
Still seems legit.
Yeah. The Edge would have been a better casting choice. He's a better actor. anyways, it's so, but that, I think that's like it, when you change mediums, you have to make trade-offs. It's, a graphic novel like Watchmen, like I know that like the execution was poor, but the reasoning for it is valid. And that's why I want to explore the reasoning for it. A graphic novel gives you a lot of opportunities, a lot of different ways to work in material, and just frankly, it's so much longer. If they adapted every single page of that, you would have to also find ways to adapt those articles and reintroduce concepts and pepper this in a way that you can't do in a film, which, well, I guess has to be less than 3 hours these days, maybe, if you're lucky, but still, like... It's, and actually I think it's like Watchmen's a great comic and it seems like it would have been the easier thing to, I'll say one of the things that might get me to sign for HBO is the Watchmen TV series that's coming out.
I'm curious about
because
that.
It's not an adaptation of Watchmen. It is, but it's a sequel to Watchmen.
Yeah. I'm curious what that's going to be.
It's going to be
I don't know how I feel about it, but I'm curious.
I want to watch it like I want to watch a slow motion train wreck. Like, I'm going to tell you, guys, stop trying to make sequels and prequels to Watchmen. It is a perfect self-contained book. It's done. Like, I mean, I'm not saying it's perfect in the sense that there aren't problematic elements or that it's not flawed, but it is like... perfect in the sense that it is finished. It is locked in. We don't need more. But I don't know. Like, so, and when you have books like with Lord of the Rings and with The Hobbit, like you've got a completed book, right? You've got something finished, but what even is adherence to the source material with superhero stuff?
I'm really glad you went there because like, It's amazing to me how many people would have jumped to that conclusion with Game of Thrones or various other things, including one anime that I've brought up before, but I'll probably bring it up again a little bit later, if they just would have followed the comic or the novel closely, it would have been better. And the Marvel Cinematic Universe hasn't done that at all.
Not remotely.
I'm just going to say it. The Marvel Cinematic Universe has not followed the source material for the most part at all, except for in the spirit of things. Go ahead.
But, may I interject?
Yes, go for it.
I want to say the beautiful thing about the comics universes, I should say, is that because they've made so many variations that they like to say technically exist next to each other. I mean, technically, the MCU could be considered one of these multiple, you know, verses, and so could technically exist side by side all the other ones, even though they want to call it, what is it, 19999
or 616, which,
well, 616 is the comic continuity.
Yeah,
the Spider-Man trailer implied that, but then again, Mysterio is the one who said it, and spoilers for anyone who hasn't read Spider-Man, but Mysterio doesn't tell the truth about
anything
ever. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, obviously also the Marvel Cinematic Universe is now a multiverse. That's a minor spoiler. And that's the only thing that can explain the current season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
For that matter, though, it's just, I like it better that way. Like, Winter Soldier is my favorite Captain America storyline, but the movie streamlined it a lot.
Yeah.
Hydra's not even in the Winter Soldier storyline. No, really. In the comic, Hydra isn't related to Winter Soldier, like, at all.
Yeah, but and what year movie, was those story? Well, you know, it's
Winter Soldier was the first book in Ed Brubaker's run, so that was early 2000s.
Okay, right, but it's while the Cold, you know, the Soviet Union had fallen 10 years earlier in 2000. You know, it's having him be even though the Soviet Union would have been around for most of the time that Bucky would have been operating in the MCU as an assassin, it's not so much it feels harder to justify in the MCU.
True, it's just
it is still Bucky, funny. He's got the red star on the arm, though.
Bucky had, yeah, it was 2005 was when Bucky first appeared as Winter Soldier. So he had been comic book dead for 60 real world years.
Jeez.
Before coming back. That was how I grew up with Bucky Barnes, by the way, people of the internet. Like, for some of you, he was that guy who died and then came back 2 years later in the movies. For me, he was a ghost who was always over the shoulder of my favorite character, making him sad all the time.
May I diverge?
Sorry, I didn't
sure.
mean to. Sure. So, yeah, go ahead.
Because speaking of the MCU, I want to make... Because I was thinking about all this and how like certain movies kind of follow certain comics, like certain comic books even. Mm-hmm. And what came to my mind was the first Iron Man movie. And telling the story of how he became Iron Man. And I remember, like, at the time, I'd known the comic book version. I'd known that story about him, you know, going to Vietnam, and that's where he became Iron Man. And one of the things I appreciated about the movie adaptation was bringing it up to, you know, the modern era.
Well, that's the thing is in the
comics.
I think
it was the right thing to do.
Well, in the comics, they keep changing what war it was.
Yeah.
It hasn't been the Vietnam War for a very long time in the comics, officially.
Well, that was the version that I read at the library.
Well, right, that's what so, it started as. Well, no,
yeah.
It didn't, did it? What year did Iron Man first come out?
1963, I want to say.
Okay.
Yeah, because he was in the line of Lee and Kirby created characters who made up what we now know as the Marvel Universe.
Well,
who
right.
were
it's...
mostly just characters Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and to an and to a very understated extent, Steve Ditko just started pulling out of their butts.
Well, yeah, it's, well, the reason I have to ask is because sometimes you get characters like Namor, who, you know, goes back further.
Tony was not one of the ones that goes back way further.
Why
Human
haven't we
Torch,
gotten an MCU Namor?
That I don't know. I've heard there might be some copyright issues with him, but...
But I was just going to say that that's one of the... It's one of the ways where I appreciate, like, them doing some changes.
Yeah.
In the adaptation to make it more, what's the word?
Accessible, relatable?
Yeah. Yep. Those to the audience.
Oh, it's...
To the modern audience.
Staying with Iron Man, it still blows my mind that to this day, I have people tell me Iron Man 3, which was my favorite of the three Iron Man films, fight me, internet. I meet people who say that that was the worst one, and sometimes I hear good arguments, but sometimes I hear it on the grounds of, well, they changed the Mandarin so much. And aside from that, the Iron Man 3 Mandarin is way less racist than his comic book counterpart. There's what for me is just a huge factor, which is it was a story with a twist I didn't see coming. Like, as a comic book reader, I don't want to know everything that's going to happen to the characters just because I read a graphic novel years prior.
Yeah, that's one of the problems of, you know, true, you know, adaptations of books is, like, if you've read the book, you know what's happening. There's no surprises for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when they do make those changes, it's like, oh, sweet, a twist.
Well, and, and
that's cool.
And sometimes just the act of adapting something, you end up with something that's a completely different beast. That it's, I think there's, so actually, here's a weird example. Let's talk about Haven. So Haven was a TV series that ran for 5 seasons, really 6, but they pretended it was 5 so they didn't have to pay the actors more on that last season, on Sci-Fi. That is loosely, and when I say loosely, I mean like the barest thread based off of a novel by Stephen King called The Colorado Kid.
Okay.
The Colorado Kid has no supernatural elements in it whatsoever. The Colorado Kid is... So The Colorado Kid is a book, Stephen, and their Hard Case Crime imprint in 2005. And it was, it's about how it's a third person narrative. So what it is that it's told in a framing story by these two older guys who run a newspaper, are telling their young intern in this small town in Maine about this mysterious death. And the whole thing is that, so there was this guy who, there was a mysterious body on the beach, and there's all these mysteries to it. And a year later, we found out who he was, and so he got nicknamed the Colorado Kid because he's this guy from Colorado. But, like, he had disappeared from Colorado 5 hours earlier and then was found dead on a beach in Maine, like, with no commercial flight records, without, like, any, like, no evidence he had been on the ferry. Like, all of this, like, there's a whole list of, and you know what? They don't solve the mystery in the book. Like, the guys telling the story have a theory that could line up with the facts, but they don't know for sure. And the whole point of the book is it's about, but there's nothing supernatural about this book.
Okay.
Right? Haven is a story about a town where every 27 years in Maine, where every 27 years the Troubles come back, which are people who are cursed with kind of these negative superpowers. Like, one of the main characters just can't feel anything. Another, you know, one of the you know, then like there's the trouble of the week half the time where it's some person where if they get mad, thunderstorms appear near them or something, or like another guy who can accidentally induce someone to time travel. Like, it is 100% supernatural. And yes, there is a mystery about who killed the Colorado kid in there. But oh my god, besides the fact that like they changed the name of the town to Haven, mostly because the name in the book is of the town is not so good on a title card. I can't ever remember what it's called. But anyways, like besides the fact that two of the characters are who run the paper are loosely based on the two guys from the book. Like, there's almost nothing, and like some character names carry over.
Right.
There's not a lot in common with the thing. So it's I mean, in theory, also in the original book, there's a minor clue supposed to connect it to the Dark Tower, according to King, but no one's sure what he means. You know.
Now, if you ask Stephen King, pretty much everything is connected to the Dark Tower, if you really press him on it.
Well, you know, it's the TV series makes tons of overt references to Stephen King stuff all the time without even, like, you know, like a character getting out of prison is getting out of Shawshank. The opening title sequence has a newspaper clipping that makes reference to Randall Flagg.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it's but it's now, is Haven a good adaptation of the Colorado Kid? I don't know. But it's really enjoyable on its own. You know what I mean? Like, it's, and it's not made bad by the fact, because originally when they were pitching it, it was not supposed to have any supernatural elements. It was going to be a straight mystery show. And what happened was Stephen King saw the script and said, hey, you don't have any supernatural stuff in here. So it's all Stephen King's fault. But it's Stephen King's fault that it's less true of an adaptation to the source material than it was going to be. And so, like, there's the question. Like, Haven might not be everyone's cup of tea. I love it. I've been rewatching it lately on Netflix, and it surprisingly holds up. I'm very excited. I'm very happy that it holds up because I enjoyed watching it the first time. But it's not made bad by the fact that it completely, like, goes sideways from what it's based on. Adherence wouldn't have made this better.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's always Full Metal Alchemist.
Yeah, I was gonna go there. I don't wanna linger on Full Metal Alchemist too long because we've gone off on that tangent several times on this show. But I do wanna say it bothers me to no end, and it really breaks my heart that a big chunk of like the online anime discourse recently, and for reasons that I don't entirely understand, maybe these are also Vic Mignogna's fault. There's been a lot of discussion about Full Metal Alchemist again, and a lot of it has been in regards to, you know, when you go back to it, it's a good thing we have Brotherhood. You don't need to watch the 2003 series ever again. And just throwing out the baby with the bathwater on that one, and I don't entirely get it.
I don't remotely get it, because here's the thing. I've never read the Full Metal Alchemist manga, right? I do not give a crap what's in there. I mean, it might be great, it might be terrible, I don't care. I don't want to sit down and read it. I have watched every episode of the 2003 anime. In fact, you know, I have seen it from beginning to end, and I've seen the movie, and I love it. I love the whole thing. I tried to watch two episodes of Brotherhood, and I hated it. Like, I understand, like, and maybe it gets better after we get parts of, like, get past the parts that are a retread of the exact same story, you know, because early Full Metal Alchemist obviously was following the manga, but also what takes a multi-episode arc in the 2003 series is done in one episode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's... I felt no connection to the characters in Brotherhood when I watched that episode. It felt completely like... It felt like a soulless recap with stupid, goofy jokes.
I will agree, because it does get better after it gets through those recaps.
Honestly,
but that's not enough for me. Go ahead.
It kind of feels like you almost need to watch, you know, the first one in order to fully understand Brotherhood.
I agree.
Like, I like them both. I feel like you need to watch both.
I'm not saying that I hate, and that's the other thing that drives me nuts, that when I get on this high, the soapbox, I don't dislike Brotherhood. But I do feel that the first 13 episodes are garbage.
And
because they're a weird rehash of the first series, and some of like the character subtlety is just gone.
Yeah.
And
I don't have the patience to sit through 13 episodes of a worse version of something that I loved.
That's fair. And I mean, I've seen some people recommend that you just watch episodes 1 through 26 of the 2003 series and then do where Brotherhood continues off, which I think is episode 14. But even there, I don't even agree. I can kind of appreciate that. I don't even agree with cutting out the latter half of the 2003 series, the one that that Bones had to write for themselves.
Yeah.
Because I don't feel that it's a bad TV show. In fact, there are some thematic elements from the 2003 series that aren't in the source material that I really appreciate.
Let's blast some Larkin Seal in here.
That too, frankly. But like, the 2003 series is much more about the sanctity of life.
Yeah.
Like, if I were to say what the overall theme of the 2003 series is, it is the sanctity of life.
Yeah.
And the way that the 2003 series handles the homunculi, it is a better D. Greyman anime than either of the actual D. Greyman anime.
I laughed because that was funny, but I've never actually seen D. Greyman or read it.
Long story short, D. Greyman is a series where there are monsters called Akuma that are made when people try to bring their dead family members back.
Ooh.
Yeah. So D. Greyman is a really sad manga that got two sad anime, but they're not sad for the reason that the manga was sad. They're sad because they're both bad and you shouldn't watch them. But yeah, like yes, the 2003 series does not follow the manga at the end, because the manga didn't exist for the other half of it. But I don't feel that the story is invalid. It's a different version of events that features the same characters that doesn't make it a bad story. I have yet to see... I'm just so sick of seeing arguments about... if anyone ever tells me why they like Brotherhood... Like, there are a lot of good reasons to like Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood. There's Ling, there's Lanfan, there's some really epic battle sequences. But if anyone ever says to me, well, it's closer to the manga, I just tune them out. I don't listen to anything else they have to say, because I don't care. I don't care that it's closer to the manga. That doesn't make it good.
So I think what we're getting to is that adherence to the style and adherence to the aesthetic is not will not make something good. Adherence to the spirit of something can make it a good adaptation, but overall, regardless of either, that something can be good if it deviates from the source material entirely, as long as it's just actually good.
Yep.
Yeah, I hate to say it. I really went into this thinking that we were going to just, you know, kind of conclude that it's more important to adhere to the spirit than to the literal text. But yeah, at the end of the day, I think I'd rather just have something good, even if it's
different.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should probably move on to the mailbag.
Yeah.
Who wants to take what?
I wouldn't mind reading the first letter that we got.
Well, why don't you take okay. that then, Nick?
Okay, this is from a friend of the show, Brittany. Subject is wonderful show. And Brittany says, recently I was listening to your podcast and realized that once you get to your mailbag that sometimes there's no mail. I write this letter to tell you all of you are doing a wonderful job. I adore your professionalism and strict standards you all give yourself to be the best convention news podcast this side of the Midwest. Please continue on. Oh, thank you, Brittany.
Well, thank you.
Sometimes you need that. I definitely needed that.
Yeah. Again, you want to take the other one?
Yeah. This one's from our good friend,
Brenda Gibner.
Thank you. I forgot how to words for a second. And she wants to tell us about Stormwood. She says, so I used to play D&D, and I'm loving Stormwood so much. I have a feeling Trey's dice are going to kill Babbitt, and I love Nick as Bill.
Woo!
The podcast makes me laugh so much and makes me miss playing D&D. I can't wait for the next episode, but thanks for doing this.
Yay.
I'm not going to lie, that felt really good.
I just finished the edit on another episode this morning. And
not just getting singled out, though, too. Like, just the fact that to know that what we're doing is appreciated, is that
Bill's
feels really
amazing,
good.
Amazing, Nick. I love Bill so though. Much. How freaked out you get every time you successfully do whatever you're doing because of the unintended consequences, the fact you keep vaporizing people. It's just...
And, like, the weird crap you keep trying to pull. Like,
oh,
I'm accidentally a prolific murderer.
It's great. It's great. So, but with the mailbag, that brings us to the Vomit Hat Steve Challenge. Oh, yeah, and so someone did guess the book, so we will be changing books this episode, but it was not KOR fan. He guessed it wrong. But the book that I had been reading for the last couple of weeks, was the Worst Case, Survival Handbook. It was the Worst Case Scenario Survival Handbook. And, so it's, that was guessed by the newest member of the Hall of Awesome, Wonderland Hearts, who is added to the Hall of Awesome. Now, what to explain the challenge, which I usually do before I start doing this, but whatever, I do things out of order. I do what I want. The Vomit Hat Steve Challenge is where I read a line from a book, and the challenge to you, the listener, is to guess what book I'm reading from. If you guess it correctly, you get included in the Hall of Awesome. The benefits of the Hall of Awesome are as follows. 1, I read your name aloud every episode. 2, I put your name on the website in the Hall of Awesome. 3, there is no third thing, but I feel that I always have to say a third thing because of this weird instinctive thing in my brain. All right. The current members of the Hall of Awesome, including the newest member, are Archimedes, Zero, Rin and Ascenti, Cheesy McDamu, Krista, Slithery D, Shameless Otaku, The Random Ramblings Band, Corfan, Capito, Chris Graham, Lily Source, Paper Godzilla, Cavsey, Minnesota Librarian, Sean Orange, Keith Shizuo, Sakura Sunset, Joel Christman, Patrick Delahanty, and Wonderland Hearts. And since I had to go and find another book, even though my office is a complete and total mess and half my books are inaccessible to me right now. Let's see here. Your line is, he pressed the heels of his hands into his eyes. If you know what book that's from, go to nerdandtie.com, click on the contact form, and tell us. Or if you have anything else you'd like to say, anything you'd like read aloud in our mailbag, any dreams that you had the other night, with you know, way too much cheese in your diet, and so it was just weird as heck. If you want to know exactly why Gen's star signs are as messed up as they are, if you want to know why Nick is secretly thinking about a hippopotamus right now, just write to us at nerdandtie.com/contact and tell us all of your thoughts. Or if you want to hear your voice out loud on the show, which is a thing that we can do, if you go to go to your phone and dial 414-375-0480 and leave us a voicemail there. Sometimes we play those on the air. And you could like be speaking here with us and pretend you're on the team, even though you're really just kind of on the other team, which is the listening team, which is a great team to be on. Let me tell you. We love having you on the listening team, but you can't come into my house.
Fair.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, I quit caffeine 2 weeks ago.
Ooh.
And you cannot tell.
Nope.
Oh.
All right. Well,
again, that wraps up the show, doesn't it?
I think so. I was one of your hosts, Gen Proc.
I'm Trey Dorn.
And I will be Nick Izumi.
And remember, you can subscribe to this podcast anywhere the greater podcasts are downloaded or sold. You can find us on the iTunes Store, on the Spotify app, on Stitcher, on tune in on anything that can take an RSS feed, and please rate and review us in all of those lovely storefronts so everyone knows how great we are. Or even in Luminary. Who the heck uses Luminary? No one, but you could use it to listen to us. Remember, you can find us on social media. On Twitter, we're at Nerd and Tie. On Tumblr, we're nerdandtie.tumblr.com. And on Facebook, we're facebook.com/nerdandtie. If you want to support the show financially, you can sponsor an episode for just $20 and we'd say something nice about you. Or you can donate to, I have a Patreon at patreon.com/TRAEGORN. You can, Nick Izumi has a Patreon at patreon.com/Nick Izumi. Gen has many things across the internet in the way of Etsy shops and stuff. Or just go look for Opsalot Dude Designs, buy her pillows. They're really nice. They look good in your house or something. I don't know. They're amazing. You should always do all those things. Click the buttons, like things if there's a thing that you can like on the thing that you're listening and looking at here. And most of all, deep down inside, we want to be your friend. And you should listen to the other shows on the network, like Stormwood and Associates, your weekly actual play podcast. Because, hey, you just heard it a few minutes ago. Brenda Gibner likes it, so you might too.
It's pretty funny, you guys.
It's really good. It's real fun.
And I spend a lot of time on those episodes in post, so.
Please listen to our show. And as always, keep on Spockin' in the free world.
Unless you don't want to. Your body, your choice. I'm just saying. That is where we stand. Also, I'm wearing pants right now.